This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In California, there is still no political deal in sight in the struggle to cut the state's massive budget deficit, and the clock is ticking as politicians debate what to do. The state controller said last week that California is less than 50 days away from a government meltdown. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger remains adamant that his approach, spending cuts and no new taxes, is the only way to go. John Myers of member station KQED sat down with the governor to hear more.
4 weeks ago today, California voters rejected a package of ballot measures that would have minimized the state's budget problems. But in an interview Monday at the state capitol in Sacramento, Arnold Schwarzenegger made it clear he thinks the legislature is dragging its feet on his $24 billion proposal to erase the deficit.
They know what needs to be done. These are all very smart people. And that's why I said in my speech, my joint address to them, that it has to do with the will. You know, do they have the will? They know exactly where the problem is. They know where the fat is in government. They know what is bloated. They know where the fraud is. They know where the abuse is. They know all of those things.
But few believe there's enough waste to solve California's massive problem. Even the governor's own budget director said recently that Schwarzenegger's plan to cut some $19 billion in spending is scraping the bottom of the barrel. Democrats in the California legislature want only about $13 billion in cuts and have rejected some of Schwarzenegger's most drastic measures. That includes his plan to abolish both welfare assistance and health care for children from poor families. Still, Schwarzenegger says if Democrats would only re-examine some of the spending demanded by labor unions and others, they could save programs like welfare, known as CalWORKs, or state parks, or financial aid for college students.
If, for instance, they say, look, we're willing to cut into this program here to create more efficiency, and here is $100 million. We can use this $100 million for keeping all the state parks open. If they go and say, here we found $1 billion in prisons, we are willing to change the law and to have all in the future all the prisons being built by the private sector and also all the new services by the private sector, and they can save $1 billion, we can go right away and put money into the Healthy Family Program, into CalWORKs, and CalGrant.
What Schwarzenegger says he will not do to solve California's financial meltdown is raise taxes. Democrats have now proposed a tax on oil drilled in California and a $15 annual tax on vehicles earmarked to fund state parks. Last year, both a handful of legislative Republicans and the Republican governor agreed to about $12 billion in new taxes. But Schwarzenegger says that was a one-time deal.
Everyone said, no, we understand that we will not address this issue of taxes or fees again. We're going to solve everything else from now on with just cuts. And so that is exactly what we said, and so there's no going back.
And time for debate is running out. California is on the verge of being $1 billion short on cash next month, and billions more by the fall. Issuing IOUs is a very real possibility. The plan is a short-term loan from Wall Street, with the debt backed by the federal government. But this morning, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said the Obama administration has no plans to step in. That means Arnold Schwarzenegger, who has staked his reputation on fiscal common sense, will apparently have to do the heavy lifting himself. For NPR News, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
The Obama administration faces a test in Congress this week over its pledge to help other countries hit by the economic crisis. One provision in a military spending bill would boost the U.S. contribution to the International Monetary Fund, and that's coming up for a vote. The administration wants to commit up to $108 billion. But with bailout fatigue on Capitol Hill, this vote could be close. IMF supporters say the institution is key to bringing the global economy back to health. NPR's Tom Gelton has more.
The $100 billion commitment from the United States, along with commitments from Japan, Europe, and other countries, would mean the IMF could triple the amount of money it could loan to needy countries. The fund is ready to move beyond its traditional role of bailing out governments that have spent themselves into a hole. Randall Henning of American University and the Peterson Institute for International Economics says the financial crisis has given the fund a new opportunity for global leadership.
The IMF looked as if it was losing relevance a couple of years ago when very few countries were coming to it for balanced payments financing. But now the IMF is very much in demand, and if it responds well, its position will be kind of greatly strengthened.
Part of the IMF's new role is to encourage governments to do stimulus spending to promote economic recovery. But it can also help prevent another global financial crisis in the future. The current problems came about in part because too many governments, especially the emerging economies, were earning so much money from exports that they didn't know what to do with it. So they loaned it out, especially to the United States, where it got put into shaky investments. The key to avoiding a repeat of the crisis is to convince those emerging market countries that everyone would be better off if they spent their export earnings at home. But some of these countries don't dare spend their money. Ishwar Prasad, a former IMF economist now at the Brookings Institution, says many emerging market countries want to hold their export earnings in reserve for use in case another economic emergency comes along. He says countries like Brazil and South Korea know the IMF does not have enough money to help them during a true financial crisis.
This forces the large emerging market economies to think about self-insuring, that is, building up large stocks of their own foreign exchange reserves.
If those countries come out of this recession and once again build up their own savings, we could be set up for another crisis. The IMF could bring about a more balanced global economy by getting those countries to spend their export earnings at home. But to do that, Prasad says the fund needs a much bigger lending capability than it now has.
Having a very large pool of resources allows these large emerging market economies to have some additional confidence that the IMF will be able to help them, even if the crisis that comes up next should be a worldwide crisis that hits all the economies hard.
If the IMF is to convince governments to change their economic policies, it'll also need more political clout. Some of the new economies don't take the fund all that seriously because they see it as dominated by the United States and other Western nations. The Obama administration, therefore, has two goals: to get the IMF more money and also to support reforms that would give the emerging economies more voting rights within the fund. But it needs Congress to go along, and there is significant opposition on Capitol Hill to any increase in U.S. support for the IMF. Jim DeMint is a Republican senator from South Carolina.
I just think under this environment, the down economy, the suffering that's going on in our own country, for us to just quickly approve another $100 billion for international bailouts makes no sense.
On the other hand, Randall Henning of the Peterson Institute says the United States owes it to the world to beef up the IMF right now, given that the global economic crisis was brought about in part by U.S. overspending.
So having contributed to the crisis in this way, if the U.S. doesn't support the IMF's attempts to deal with the collateral damage, the United States loses credibility and international standing greatly.
One factor working in favor of the IMF commitment is that it is embedded in a bill to fund the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Administration officials are cautiously optimistic that the IMF money will get congressional approval. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
We're about to tell a story with five characters. Four are people. The fifth is the wind. That's the wind thundering across the high plains of Oklahoma. In a stagnant economy, it may be the wind of change. Americans are building more wind turbines, putting up those giant white propellers to capture the energy in the air. And the growing wind industry is the latest subject of our series, Generation Next. Our guest correspondent, Judy Woodruff, met a young man who walked out of his old job and stepped into the wind.
Or you could say Quentin Johnson climbs into the wind, because that's what you do to fix a wind turbine. You climb 300 feet up.
This is a harness, and this is a lanyard, and these things, you hook these up.
Quentin was one of the first students to enroll in a new training program in Woodward, Oklahoma. He's learning to be a wind energy technician.
I'm going to walk over here, and I'm going to lanyard climb for you.
But when most people think about energy in Oklahoma, they think of the fuel that comes from the ground. Oil and natural gas help build this state. There are oil derricks all around Woodward. There's even one at Quentin's school. That's what he uses to practice climbing.
So, Quentin, how hard was that?
Not very, but day in, day out, all day. It'll get pretty tiring.
Quentin probably doesn't need much practice. He's worked in oil fields since he got out of high school. He's climbed derricks as high as 200 feet.
You've got to be in good shape.
Yeah.
And you're not afraid of heights.
I used to be, but I've gotten over it.
But what was the first time and the second time?
It was rough. I didn't want to let go of anything. Just kind of hugged on the things. Matter of fact, the first time I just made it about halfway up and I come back down. It was too much.
Why did you stick with it?
The money. The money was great.
The oil money was great. $50,000 a year at its peak when the demand for oil was soaring. When oil prices plummeted late last year, so did Quentin's paycheck. He was 22 years old and had a wife and baby daughter.
My last check for 2 weeks was $500 when it used to be $2,000. That's when I got out.
So this just happened all of a sudden, or how much warning did you have?
No, we were working really hard for 5-6 months. I mean, they'd even call us in on our days off sometimes, and all of a sudden it just quit.
And when the oil and gas business quit, it quit for a lot of people.
Are you in?
Kimberly Smithton watches the ebb and flow of oil and jobs in Woodward. She's a manager at the High Plains Technology Center where Quentin trains. This year, she got calls from laid-off oil workers, all asking, how do I get into wind?
Now, let me just explain to you what we're looking at here. These are drilling rigs. They call this stacked. When there's nothing to drill, they stack them in the yard. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 rigs stacked on this side. It's just a sad sight.
I don't see anybody around here.
No. 6 or 8 months ago, these rigs would have been out. They would have been working. And there would have been people working.
The oil business is known for its cycles of boom and bust, and some workers will wait for things to bounce back.
Come here.
But Quentin Johnson needs an income now. His daughter is 15 months old, and there's another baby on the way.
Hello.
Who is it?
Take the phone to Daddy.
When Quentin and his wife Mallory talk about the lives they led when he was making good money, they seem to be telling the stories of millions of Americans.
When he worked in the oil field, living on that kind of money, for us being so young, we could go out and do pretty much anything we wanted.
Yeah. Go watch movies, go to the mall, do whatever, and haven't done that in 6 months.
I mean, obviously it's more stress. You wonder, how am I going to pay this? I wish we wouldn't have gotten that because now we have to pay for it. And how do we fix this and how do we fix it now? And you just can't.
As Mallory and Quentin talk, his mother sits nearby. Kim Collins has long gray hair and eyes that seem to have seen everything. She is as tall as her son, 6'2". And for a while, they shared the same livelihood. She drives a truck for the oil companies.
It made me a good living. It's just not stable. You know, my dad was in the oil field in the early 80s when it went bust, and so I've seen what it, you know, it's been here one day and it's gone the next. But the windmills are going to be there. Once they put them up, they're there.
Quentin listens to his mother and nods his head. He's seen 300 turbines go up around Woodward. He's read the estimates that wind will bring thousands of jobs to Oklahoma. He's seen the president on TV pushing renewable energy and backing it with stimulus money. He knows wind can't save the economy here. The industry is too small. But to Quentin, the wind feels like something he can touch.
Everybody's asking me how to get into it. Everybody's calling it the new oil field.
Had you paid much attention before to the whole idea of renewable energy, green energy?
No, because I worked in the oil and gas industry, and that's where my life came from. And I wanted to use oil and gas because that's what brought a paycheck home.
And if you stay in this industry, what do you see yourself doing in 10 years, 20 years?
I'd like to be a wind farm manager.
So maybe not climb the towers for 20 years.
I just like to boss people around.
Quentin graduates from the wind training program in 2 weeks. His second child is due about the same time. He's looking for a job as a wind technician, but nothing yet. Meanwhile, a temptation from his former life. Oil prices have been climbing up, and not long ago, Quentin's former boss asked if he wanted his old job in the oil fields back. We called Quentin to ask him about it.
He asked me if I wanted the job, but I couldn't quit school with a month left, so I turned him down.
Was that a tough decision?
Very. It was a job for $2,000 every 2 weeks. That's pretty tough for anybody to turn down. But I know that it might not be a long-term job. They could drill one hole with that rig and then stack it back out, and I'd be without a job again. So the more I thought about it, the better off I knew I'd be if I just tough it out and go with the wind.
For NPR News, I'm Judy Woodruff.
And Generation Next continues this evening on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS as well as on Morning Edition. And you can see how the unemployment figures for Generation Next compare with the rest of the globe and with previous recessions by going to NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
And for more now on the budget problems in California, we turn to Joe Matthews. He's a former reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's now a senior fellow with the New America Foundation. That's a nonpartisan public policy institute. Mr. Matthews, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Now, it's hard to find a state right now that's not swimming in red ink yet. Why is California in particularly bad shape?
In a nutshell, California has institutionalized in its constitution the worst and most irresponsible impulses of both liberal and conservative governance, low taxes and sort of autopilot spending. And we have a very inflexible initiative process, a constitution that it's easy to add things to but hard to take things away from. And the result is we've sort of institutionalized a structural budget deficit that existed before the economic collapse. The economic collapse has just made it much worse.
And the initiative that limits property taxes probably compounds this problem.
It's a part of the problem, but while it's often described as a huge part of the problem, it's not. It's just one of many similar measures that have helped create this larger problem.
Now, California is one of several states that are trying to make the case for a federal bailout right now. Top officials from Sacramento and some of the mayors have been pressing the White House to save the state, saying California is too big to fail. Now, that's an argument that had mixed results for the auto industry. What about the Golden State?
I think it's an argument that inevitably is going to win. When the White House says, well, we're not going to do this now, I think there's wiggle room in that. We have no plans to do this. Eventually, when the state starts to run out of cash in late July, we may be able to forestall that for some period of time. But eventually, we're going to need help. I don't think it's actually quite right to call that a bailout. Essentially, all we need is essentially a letter of credit from the federal government guaranteeing our loans. But I think there's an opportunity in federal intervention and federal assistance for the state. We are incapable, I think, as a state, of getting the two-thirds in our legislature that's required for changes in the budget or for tax increases. So ultimately, we won't be able to solve this problem. The advantage of federal assistance is that there would be strings attached, and I think those strings would involve some sort of budget plan for California, forcing us to adopt one, to have the cash to using the leverage of this cash shortage to force us to adopt a real budget plan that we stick to with penalties. And I think it's actually an opportunity, and given our inability to govern ourselves, I think it's sort of inevitable that the feds will have to step in.
As to that point, though, this notion that California might be too big to fail, the people making that argument, do they have a point? Do the budget problems in California, are the budget problems in California so large, is the economy so large there that it could tank the entire national economy?
I mean, the state government, all the budget is only about $130 billion annually. We have a GDP of $3 trillion. I don't think it's the economy that's a threat. The threat that California poses and the state government poses is to other governments in the country, other states, and I think particularly other local governments, cities and counties that are in a bit of trouble because of the economic climate. If there would be some sort of meltdown or, goodness knows, default, which I think is almost impossible, but if things get very bad, we could make it harder for other cities and counties to borrow all over the country and thus make things very bad all across the country. It could be kind of a financial contagion in the bond markets.
Almost out of time, but just a multiple choice question. We heard about the possibility of a financial meltdown, a real meltdown. Is that hyperbole or a real possibility? Which one?
It's hyperbole with an audience of both trying to create interest in tax increases, and it's a message to the feds that we need some help.
Thank you so much. That's Joe Matthews. He's with the New America Foundation.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.